You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship radio station in the Quad City region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and for today's show, I had a totally different topic planned for discussion, but in light of the events of the week, as important, as disturbing as they are, especially the events of Wednesday, caused me to shift gears and recap for our listeners what's happened during the week and provide some thoughts on the impact and implications for the future. Joining me, I'm very privileged to have on the show John Fassman. He's the formerly the Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine, and he's now the U.S. digital editor, just starting this year, of this respected magazine. John, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, we've had just an incredible week, and it just seems like the news cycle, it seems just something really unprecedented happens almost daily anymore. But we'll shift gears from the original topic and talk about the events of what happened Wednesday in Washington. I know things are still unfolding, and as we're taping here today for our audience, we're taping this on Thursday, so a lot could still happen between now and when the show airs. Do you have some updated information on some topics? Number one, I think most people are wondering what happened with that caused law enforcement to have kind of a scattershot approach. I saw some video of them just letting people, these rioters, through. Other cases, they seem to be trying to stop them. Is there any more information on what their strategy was from the top of the Capitol Police?
There's none that I've heard yet. And I also was struck by a couple of things about the police response. The first was, as you say, it was quite scattershot. It seemed to me to be, you know, perhaps a failure of imagination, that they knew there was a demonstration planned, but they didn't think it could turn violent like this, and so were unprepared for the ferocity of the insurrectionists. I also wonder whether the fact that President Trump supported the mob, that is, let me think about how to phrase that in a more elegant way. I also wonder whether the fact that people knew that the demonstrators were supporters of President Trump's maybe led other agencies to sort of be a little more hesitant than they otherwise would have been. I mean, I'm thinking of the disparity between how police responded to these armed insurrectionists storming the Capitol and how they responded and prepared for peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters. I think that difference is really quite striking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in the next few days, I would expect we're going to hear a lot more about how the Capitol Police are rethinking security. I saw a news report that said that Chuck Schumer, when he becomes majority leader, will fire the Senate Sergeant-at-Arms. I expect the House Sergeant-at-Arms is probably on his way out also. And I expect some changes to Capitol security procedures. Now, I hope one of the glories, to my mind, having covered politics in other countries, one of the glories of the Capitol is that it is open, that you can just walk through the halls, you can stop in legislators' offices. I hope that doesn't go away, but I would think they're going to rethink how they secure that building.
Yeah. I've been there multiple times, and I agree with you. It's the people's body, and I think what these people were saying yesterday to defend themselves, it's how they went about it, obviously. And and again, we're getting clips, we're getting news still develop on this, but I heard stories today that some of the reporters that were there, there was no doubt that there were ringleaders here, that this was planned over social media. They knew what they were doing, but others seemed like almost in awe walking around the Capitol for the first time.
Yeah, that was a stunning thing, right? They didn't seem to have a goal other than sort of breaking in and making noise. There wasn't, it seemed to be a sort of display of chaos, or as I like to name it, it was a very sort of Trumpian display of strength, in that it was a temper tantrum, and it didn't really lead anywhere other than frightening people and making noise.
One of the more disturbing things to me was just the notion of somebody carrying a Confederate flag through Congress. It's coming out more where people were wearing anti-Semitic, really disturbing anti-Semitic clothing. This notion of hate that has been bred in people in this country is perhaps one of the things that's most disturbing about what's been going on in the last couple of years in the United States. In your reporting, I'm sure you've noticed this, it seems more prevalent, it seems more open. This is a deep chasm in this country, and I really fear about how we're going to go about trying to heal a bit and narrow this. But boy, that's a big task.
It's a huge task. And I also saw the Confederate flag. I mean, even during the Civil War, that traitor's flag never made it into the Capitol building. I saw the shirts as well. I mean, I am Jewish. I'm the son of refugees who came here to escape anti-Semitism. This country has given us everything. And to see those shirts on display worn by supporters of an American president was a feeling like I've never had before.
I can't imagine, John. I'm sorry. That's just horrible. We all feel that way. The shock of seeing this in our nation's capital. But more than that, just the fact that that's still out there and that prevalent in this country, and I guess the roots of hate are what I'm trying to really get a grasp on. What is it that these folks are so unhappy about? Maybe I'm blinded to it, but I guess I'm having trouble understanding that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's no sort of sociological explanation that makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. It's true that, I mean, you know this better than I do, that a lot of rural areas have really been left behind. But, you know, a lot of inner city areas have really been left behind, and I've never encountered that sort of vicious hatred before. I will also say this, that I've probably been, over the past 4 years, I've been to dozens of Trump rallies, and I've heard the chants, and, you know, there's always a period at which Donald Trump calls out the media and the crowd turns to us and starts gesticulating, but not one time in any rally that I've been to have I spoken to someone who has been less than courteous one-on-one with me. So even at the Trump rallies themselves, when he was president, I didn't see that level of sort of personalized viciousness.
Yeah. Well, this one of the things that's going on in around the world that I took note of was the jailing of some Hong Kong opposition legislators, which is very disturbing.
Yeah.
And normally this would be probably front page. It's not. But it leads to some fears, I guess, that people have concerns that with this happening shown all over the world, the United States has been a beacon for liberty and a place where people were trying to come to, and this really seems to me, anyway, to damage our reputation around the world.
I agree. How can we push for free and fair elections and the peaceful transfer of power and democracy when we have one of our two major political parties that seems to have turned against it?
Yeah, we've had expressions of concern come from different countries, Canada, mm-hmm. Britain, and the healing process of trying to, it seems like there's going to be monumental tasks here for President-elect Biden when he takes over that I don't think were anticipated. And also the possibility in your contacts around, is there concern that some of our countries around the world that are challenging us, Russia, China, Iran, may try something right now to do something that would, while we seem distracted with internal problems?
Oh, yeah. I'd be very nervous right now if I were in Taiwan or Hong Kong or Estonia or Ukraine. I'd be very, very worried. I don't think there's ever been this degree of this much of a vacuum of presidential leadership in American history before.
Yeah. So I want to look at the two political parties because there was major news this week on both fronts. The Republican Party, of course, several senators, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley from nearby here in Missouri, participated in this rally to kind of whip people up. And then you still had, in spite of all this, more than half of the Republican delegation in the House vote not to accept the Electoral College results from two states. Where's this going with the Republican Party in the post-Trump era, or will this be a post-Trump era?
I think that's the big question, isn't it? And that's one reason you may have seen our issue this week has on the cover a picture of a man sitting in a picture of a rioter sitting in the dais in the Senate. The headline is Trump's legacy, the opportunity, the shame, and the opportunity.
Yeah.
What we meant by that is that what happened yesterday was clearly shameful. It was a dark moment in our nation's history. The opportunity it presents is that it may make it, we would hope, that it makes it easier for Republicans to break with Trump. And one of the things that's been striking about this period is that if you talk to elected officials off the record, behind the scenes, no one really has a kind word to say about President Trump. Nobody likes being bullied like that. And his two staunchest supporters, you know, Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, they don't want him to be politically viable anymore, right? They don't want him to nurse this story that an election was stolen from him and he's the rightful nominee for 4 years and find his way back into and become the nominee in 2024 based off of that. They want to be the nominee. But they also don't want to antagonize his base. I think what they are playing for is a deeply cynical game in which they sort of figure that some combination of financial trouble, legal trouble, inertia, sloth sort of renders Trump politically unviable before 2024, and they can just slide into the position as head of his base. That is a deeply cynical game, even if it works. But I don't know where the Republican Party is heading now. They have to figure out a way. Usually, when a candidate leads to catastrophic losses, the way that Richard Nixon did, the way that George W. Bush did in 2008, the party sort of turns away from them and shuns them. I don't really see that happening now with Trump in quite the same way. There's very little vocal discontent with him from anyone with a sort of political future in the party.
There's concern right now about the rest of his term, which is only 13 more days. But I've seen and heard a lot of concerns expressed about what he could do. And this is just alarming to try to get into the president's mental state of potentially doing something here to either maintain power or, like yesterday, to fan further dissent and violence in the United States. This 25th Amendment, which most people probably knew nothing about, but we are getting somewhat of a history lesson, a civics lesson. Talk of that. There's talk of impeachment. Is there any realistic opportunity? And we talk about Republicans. Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, not too far from here, has called for the 25th Amendment. Any realistic chance of this in the next 13 days?
I don't know. The 25th Amendment talk, I mean, that cropped up around the time of the Mueller investigation. And then it always seemed to me a liberal fantasy that you were going to have Mike Pence, who has been deeply loyal to President Trump and half his cabinet, decide that he was unfit to hold office. I didn't see that happening then. Now the talk seems slightly more serious, although I still think it's a really high hurdle to get over. There are a number of questions are, would you have more than half the cabinet who would sign that with Mike Pence? Would Mike Pence sign such a statement? What about the role of acting cabinet officials? Do they get a say? I think that's unclear. Mm-hmm. And it would provoke a legal challenge. So I think it's not impossible, and it's something I've heard more of than in the past, but it still is a very difficult thing to do. And I think the same is true for impeachment. We have at least one congressperson that I know of drawing up articles of impeachment. That's Ilhan Omar. It's difficult for me to see anything different happening than what just happened, although, you know, I'm prepared to be pleasantly surprised. Maybe the scales have fallen from a critical mass of Republican senators' eyes.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. My guest today is John Fassman, who's the U.S. digital editor of The Economist magazine, one of the most respected magazines, if not the most respected in the world. I've been a subscriber for many years, and partly because of my knowing John and him being a guest on my show over the years, it's some outstanding reporting. We've been talking about the events that have happened this week in Washington, and I wanted before we talk about the Democrats, I wanted to something incredible. Another thing that happened this week that was just incredible, and it was before the riots, the insurrection that took place in Washington, was this remarkable letter signed by numerous military officials that served as almost a warning to the president. Can you talk about that a minute, what exactly it was and what its impact is? And I guess the question is the military standing by to have to intervene?
Well, that's a good question. It was a striking letter. It was written by all 10 living defense secretaries and was organized, as I understand it, by Eric Edelman, who was an ambassador, and Elliot Cohen. They sort of spearheaded it. It was a power move also by the Cheneys. Liz Cheney has come out against Donald Trump's tactics to overturn the election. I think Dick Cheney got worried and thought it was time to intervene and essentially warned military and civilian officials, and civilians who work in the DOD that if they tried to intervene in elections, they would be subject to civil and criminal penalties. It was really a shot across the bow. Now, I think that it's very hard for me to imagine the military would intervene on Donald Trump's behalf, given how unstable he is, given how contemptuous he's been of high-ranking military officials. But I think this letter was, I wonder if this letter was maybe aimed at Trump more than at the military itself, or aimed at the civilians he's installed in high positions at DOD more than at the military itself.
It's a chilling topic to even be talking about, but it has to be because whether there was an implicit message in that letter, again, intervening on his behalf or perhaps having to intervene to prevent him from any type of further actions that are harmful to the country, which is just a shocking topic to be discussing. I want to turn to Georgia. I know you did some reporting on these races this week, and this has been just kind of brushed over after what's happened. But this was really an historic election in Georgia. Were you surprised by the results of the Democrats picking up both seats? I know I was, I have to admit. But based on your reporting, were you surprised, or give us your impressions from your reporting there?
Yeah, you know, I'll say this. I not only reported a bunch this past fall from Georgia, but I opened our Atlanta office. I covered the American South out of Atlanta for 4.5 years, from 2010 to 2014. And every single election there, Democrats would get really excited and say, Georgia's about to go blue. Look at the demographic changes. You know, look at the growth in the suburbs of Atlanta. Look at this sort of incredibly diverse, vibrant city. The rural population is declining. Urban population is increasing. This is the year it goes blue. And I saw Michelle Nunn lose a Senate race. I saw Jason Carter lose a governor's race. And it just never seemed to happen. And so I had low expectations this year. It seemed to me that Joe Biden won by a razor-thin margin and David Perdue got more votes than Donald Trump did. So that meant, to my mind, that there had to be a sizable number of Biden-Perdue voters. And I sort of assumed that when Trump wasn't on the ballot, that a lot of the soft Republicans who voted for Biden, who couldn't stand Trump and voted for Biden, would go home and vote for Perdue and Loeffler and lower taxes. That didn't happen. In addition to that, the work that Stacey Abrams and Sayufa and the New Georgia Project has done over the past decade in registering voters, in mobilizing young non-white voters, really paid off this time. I mean, it paid off in the presidential race, but it really paid off this time. Raphael Warnock, as you know, is the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is where Martin Luther King Jr. and Sr. preached. He just inspired immense African-American turnout, and that, combined with depressed turnout for the Republicans, put the two Democrats over the edge.
Really interesting for the future, too, in elections, that the turnout was the big concern Republicans had without Donald Trump on the ballot. And, of course, he was successful in bringing a lot of people to vote in November. But it just seems like the Republicans struggle to get a lot of those voters out when he's not on the ballot, and that's going to have implications down the road.
Yeah, and he also spent time sort of suppressing the vote, right? Telling people that the vote was rigged, you can't trust the system, your elected officials are all corrupt. So if someone hears that, especially if a non-frequent voter hears that, you can imagine someone who maybe doesn't vote very much, who feels alienated from the system, and that's why they supported Trump. And then to hear the candidate they supported, Donald Trump, say, the system's rigged, the powers that be are against you, the vote's rigged, it's all a sham. You know, would you really sort of pull yourself out to the polls if you're not going to be able to vote for the candidate you really like? Do you really pull yourself out to the polls to vote for two Republicans who you may not have strong feelings about? I don't think so. And people did.
It certainly manifested itself. I think that's, I think, the Georgia administrative elections put the blame on Trump for this result, which was very interesting. And he's a Republican himself. John, will look into the crystal ball. Will the fact that the combination of these events, just remarkable, an African-American and a young Jewish man elected to the Senate from Georgia, which will give Democrats control, which is good for Democrats, but then again, it could be perilous down the road. But will this, and plus the events of this week at the Capitol, will any of this, do you think it'll serve to shift the opening priorities of the Biden administration at all?
That's a great question. That's a great question. My initial read is to say probably not, right? His top priority when he gets in is still going to be vaccinations, COVID, relief for unemployment, and then after that, I expect some ethics reform bills. You know, I expect a very quick bill to make presidents release their tax returns, other sort of codifications of norms into laws. After that, I really don't know if this changes the priority or it changes the tone at all. I think Biden's always come in as a unifier. He made the very difficult but correct decision this entire race to run a quiet campaign. And so even when Donald Trump was saying outrageous things, the election has been stolen, that Biden is a socialist, Joe Biden chose to hang back and sort of let Trump punch himself out. I'm going to be curious to see what he does when he no longer can do that, when he has to be the president. I mean, he may run a fairly quiet presidency. I think there are a lot of Americans who would welcome the chance to be bored by politics again. But I think the first things he's going to have to do still are a vaccine plan, COVID relief, and ethics reform.
In the last part of our show, we have about 4 or 5 minutes left here. I want to something that, again, that's been going on the last couple weeks, but really longer than that, but really accentuated, is just the role of the news media and the struggle and the frustration that untruths, misinformation, and outright lies being spread up to, including the president. And what I'm talking about is this idea that the election was stolen.
Yeah.
It's people believe it. We had protests right in the Quad Cities of people who were on TV saying the election was stolen. And it's just not true. Okay. How in the world, this is a big question for you, but I mean, how are we going to address this with the number of local newspapers closing down? People have fewer news sources, the old-time news sources, and they're relying on social media, which you follow it, I do. It can be a real cesspool of lies that people are believing. We're in a mess now with this, and a democracy rests upon a foundation of educated citizens. Our founders said that.
Yeah.
How are we going to go about repairing this as well?
I really don't know, and I think the siloing of people into separate information spheres, the inability of people to agree on a basic set of facts and truth is really perilous for the health of our democracy, for any democracy.
Yeah.
I will say that, you know, if I were Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, I would throw down a few billion dollars and subsidize local newspapers all over the country, because you really need that as a foundation of an informed citizenry, and you need watchdogs to keep elected officials and other people in the community honest. And so I'd love to see some plan. The old model doesn't work, right? The subscription model for small town newspapers that are funded by advertisements, that's just gone. So as much as I'd like to think that a different commercial model will emerge, it hasn't yet. So until then, I would love to see nonprofit local papers all over the country.
And there are publications like yours and public radio. I'm biased there, but public radio is still a good source for objective news and analysis like we're doing today.
But there are. They're good outlets like NPR, like us, like the Times, the Journal, but that's different from a good local paper. You need people in communities who know the communities, who can talk to people in those communities.
Just a final question. We've got about a minute here. I want to end on a hopeful note here. We did have some good things happen. Congress did go through with the electoral procedure, so there are some good things happening. Our system has held here after a very disturbing day. Anything else you want to share, I guess, to leave on a high note as we move forward?
A high note. That's tough today. I will say, you know, I am an optimist by nature. And I like to think that the events of yesterday were so shocking and so gruesome that they impel the Republican Party to take a good long look at itself. They impel people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz to reconsider what they've done. And if they can't reconsider what they've done, I would hope that you get a more principled conservative, a Larry Hogan or a Ben Sasse, that finds himself politically viable and a nominee for 2024. I know that a lot of people have fantasies about, you know, they're never voting for another Republican and letting the Republican Party destroy itself. Democracy can't work as a one-party system. We cannot have one party that is committed to democracy and institutions and another party that wants to burn down the institutions and is flirting with authoritarianism. So my hope is that the events of yesterday were so horrific that they shocked the Republican conscience.
Well, John, I appreciate you that and being on the show. And again, we're still processing information. I know some of the questions I asked were difficult, but I do appreciate you handling them in a professional manner, as you always do. And again, thank you for taking the time today, a very hectic day, a very difficult day for Americans to be on the show. I do appreciate it.
It is always a great conversation with you, Robin. Always a pleasure.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.